Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Once upon a time, there was a class of people who were considered above reproach. Mostly, they were the arty set, the literati, those people who lived on the Upper West Side of the city that never sleeps. They went to museums on the regular and lunched where others could see them and with whom they were lunching. Once upon a time, a writer could make a living, rent a pretty nice, albeit small, apartment in Manhattan, and get by on her wits. Once upon a time, before security cameras were everywhere, being a little light-fingered around other people's treasures was considered ill-mannered and bad form, but hardly amounted to something to be remarked upon in good company. To do so would have been equally rude. But even the hoi polloi had their limits. That's when theft and fraud became crimes of moral turpitude, acts too egregious to overlook, acts that show a certain depravity and a breach of accepted standards, which cannot be abided. As true as it is that one man's trash is another man's treasure, so too, one person's petty theft is another person's crime of the centuries. This is one of those stories. Now, if you listened last week, you heard a case steeped in mob mayhem, the Lufthansa heist, where an airport robbery was followed by a trail of bodies. And if you stick around for the next 2 weeks, you'll hear something darker still, the story of a self-styled prophet who orchestrated the slaughter of an entire family. By comparison, the story today may feel feather light, and nobody died, no blood spilled. The injuries here are harder to see, a betrayal of trust, a vandalism of history, a thumbed nose at scholarship. But that's what makes Crimes of the Centuries what it is. It's not always about the crime with the biggest body count or splashiest headline. Sometimes it's about the quieter heists, the frauds that seem almost victimless, until you look closer. And then you see how a single act, repeated again and again, can ripple outward, shaking confidence in institutions, corrupting the historical record, and leaving future generations wondering what, if anything, they can believe. What writer Lee Israel did in 1991 amounted to a small injury to a few, but it represented something larger than that. She dismissed her transgressions as a quirk of modern life, but they were, at worst, much more. They were deliberate and unrepentant crimes against all that scholarship stands for. They made a mockery of authenticity and a statement about a certain brand of elite celebrity. Lee Israel was no Manson. She was a letter forger who chose her epistolary muses from a select few like playwright Noel Coward, silent movie star Louise Brooks, writers Edna Ferber, Dorothy Parker, Lillian Hellman, Margaret Mitchell, and even Ernest Hemingway. To suggest they would not have been outraged had they been alive is ridiculous. No one wants what purports to be their private thoughts forged into truth by a lesser writer or celebrity. But they were dead and couldn't complain. That's why God made librarians. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Galatea. You know what I love about cooler nights? The excuse to grab a blanket, curl up, and actually take a few minutes for myself.
And by a few minutes, you mean staying up until 2 a.m. saying just one more chapter?
Okay, true. But that's exactly why I love Galatea. It's a reading app with a massive library of romance stories, everything from forbidden love to bad boy billionaires to slow burn fantasy. And they keep adding new chapters and series every single week.
No wonder over 30 million people have already fallen in love with reading on Galatea.
Exactly. Galatea is a reading app where everyone craving a little more me time can dive into stories that leave you feeling recharged and fulfilled. It makes that stolen pocket of time at the end of the day something to actually look forward to.
Right now, Galatea is offering our listeners an extra 25% off on top of an already irresistibly affordable subscription when you go to galatea.com/COTC.
That's galatea.com/COTC to indulge in unlimited stories for even less.
galatea.com/COTC.
Lenore Carol Israel, better known as Lee, had the simplest of ambitions. She wanted to be a freelance journalist and author and live among the sophisticated in the heart of Manhattan. She wanted to take lunches with publishers. She wanted recognition. A graduate of Brooklyn College in 1961, a young Lee hit the pavement early on, hustling stories about film and television for the abundance of newspapers New York still supported at the time. She wasn't picky. Her byline appeared in both the New York Times and Soap Opera Digest. The pay was good enough for her to move into a small studio apartment on Riverside Drive on the Upper West Side, where rent control gloriously reigned and having writers in the building seemed to carry a certain cachet. When things grew tight, she could stretch with welfare benefits. Those times at first were fleeting, but became a bit of a chronic issue eventually. She admitted to being bad with money and was, she lamented, Dionysian to the quick. Small aside, Dionysian is a term borrowed from the Greek god Dionysus. It means passionate, chaotic, given to indulgence, emotional to the point of madness. When you hear the rest of her story, you may think, and I did, that the term applies. Maybe it's even a bit of an understatement. In any case, Lee was often in debt, behind on taxes, and forever borrowing from friends for loans or pleading with editors for a quick-paying assignment. It was generally agreed among those who knew her that she was ill-suited to working in an office, putting in regular hours, and making nice with coworkers. She just wasn't built for that. All that is a nice way of saying that she was cranky and ill-mannered, often drunk and slovenly, hard to get along with and hard to like. That said, she knew how to research and she knew how to write. Her acerbic wit was considered a bit of a weapon. At the age of 33, in 1972, Israel wrote her first biography, Miss Tallulah Bankhead, published by Berkeley Books. Lee had tracked down the stage and film star herself, interviewing Bankhead and her circle. The book was well received, with Israel later noting it had, quote, respectable sales and attracted many admirers, especially in the gay community, end quote. That success meant she was wined and dined for a while, then offered a second book contract by Delacorte Press, which she readily accepted. In 1979, she published Kilgallen, a biography of Dorothy, a high-profile journalist and television personality who worked in the 1950s and 60s before dying suspiciously while investigating the assassination of President Kennedy. That, too, was considered by readers as some nice, even-handed, and thorough work. But books took time, and by the time the next offer came her way, she reported she was down to her last $500 in her last IRA. Big-name publisher Macmillan approached her and asked her to write a warts-and-all kind of book on the cosmetic magnate Estée Lauder. Estée's people got word of that and offered Israel the equivalent of more than $200,000 in today's money to write the book without the warts. Maybe greed is a trait of Dionysus, because Israel told the Princess of Perfume that she would pass. Macmillan paid more. The book, Estée Lauder, Beyond the Magic, came out in early 1985. Estée's own sanitized book on her life followed just a few months later. That was a bit of bad timing. Beyond the Magic had been totally unauthorized and had ended up a bit of a rush job as Macmillan was anxious to get Israel's book on the shelves before Lauder's. Sales were as dismal as the reviews. She later wrote in her memoir that, quote, the Estée Lauder biography was the beginning of the end for me as a hotshot writer, end quote. Here are Israel's own words, read by the actress Jane Curtin.
I had never known anything but up in my career, had never received even one of those formatted no-thank-you slips that successful writers look back upon with triumphant jocularity. And I regarded with pity and disdain the short-sleeved wage slaves who worked in offices. I had no reason to believe life would get anything but better. I had had no experience failing.
She was about to get used to it. Forced now to take temporary jobs, some lasting only a few days, Israel ended up doing things like editing legal briefs for lawyers short on grammatical skills, to being a personal assistant to a Wildlife Foundation president who asked her to balance her teenager's checkbooks. Talk about wasted talent. In most cases, Lee would be Lee, and sooner rather than later, she would tell her employers where to put their checkbooks and their briefs. This led to the inevitable and unenviable choice of having to sell off some of her many books. Usually, that meant a trip to the famous Strand Bookstore, the legendary East Village landmark, where you could unload used volumes in exchange for enough cash to, you know, eat. Having done this successfully multiple times, she became enraged when, one day, the bookstore's buyer didn't want what she was selling. An argument ensued. Israel wrote that the whole thing went rather badly from there. Quote, I'm sure that the words glacial, merchant, and prick issued from my mouth, and probably Pickwickian as well. It's my pre-tears word, never having bothered to look it up. And then, with a glorious Ruthian swing, I swept the load of hefty books off the counter onto his wooden floors, whereupon I was 86th from the Strand, one of my last sources of disposable income, end quote. That blacklisting meant she was reduced to selling her books on the sidewalk in front of her Riverside Drive building. Schlepping them further was out of the question, while hiding from neighbors who might wonder why she was hawking paperbacks on the street. Such transactions were not lucrative. She secured a few dollars for each sale. One does what one has to do, but she figured one doesn't have to enjoy it. She would exact her own revenge. Having made note of one of the younger buyers who had witnessed her Strand meltdown and who had personally escorted her out of the bookstore and told her never to return, Israel hatched a plan. While out and about in town one day, she happened to notice the young buyer leaving his apartment with a small dog in tow. The dog was wearing a pricey leash, and the pair looked to be setting out for a walk. Israel entered his building, walked to the mailboxes, and took down some names of those who lived there. The next day, as she recalled it, she phoned the bookstore from a payphone and asked for the clerk. When he answered, she pretended to be a frantic neighbor, screaming that their building was on fire and firefighters were refusing to save the animals trapped inside. Panicked, the horrified clerk bolted from the store and tore off toward home. Israel had not set the apartment on fire, of course, but she figured he deserved a little terror. So sure was she that everyone would find this funny that she included the episode gleefully in her own memoir. She later shrugged off that some people just couldn't take a joke. And she added, with a kind of perverse relief, that it was lucky her phone had been disconnected for non-payment. Otherwise, she might have escalated herself into even deeper trouble. The real trouble would come with or without a phone. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by ButcherBox. Fall is finally here, and I'm already buying new Halloween decorations and plotting out holiday meals. The one thing I don't want to stress about? Making sure we've got enough good food on hand to feed everyone.
Yeah, the freezer should not look scarier than the Halloween decorations. ButcherBox fixes that. They deliver over 100 premium protein choices straight to your door, including 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork, raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood.
For nearly a decade, ButcherBox has led the industry with meat and seafood that's antibiotic-free, hormone-free, and independently verified.
We've been stocking up as we head into the season, and it feels good knowing we've got quality options ready for whatever comes up, from weeknight dinners to big family get-togethers.
ButcherBox makes it easy. You can choose a curated plan or fully customize your box to fit your schedule and preferences.
As an exclusive offer, our listeners can get free protein in every box for a year, plus $20 off your first box when you go to butcherbox.com/COTC.
Go to butcherbox.com/COTC to get this limited time offer and free shipping always.
That's butcherbox.com/COTC. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you had walked into Lee Israel's home in the late 1980s, you'd have known something she herself wouldn't admit for years. She was literally falling apart. Her studio apartment was thick with flies, partly because she was a terrible housekeeper, partly because her 21-year-old cat, Jersey, was no longer agile enough to use the litter box. Israel hadn't noticed or didn't care. When she finally did become aware, she dared not tell the apartment house manager because she feared she might be ousted, and she desperately needed to hold on to the roof over her and Jersey's heads. Using a public phone, she called an exterminator to rid her of those multiplying flies. He refused to enter until she had done some serious cleaning. Friends were tired of her, publishers wouldn't take her calls. She had to figure out a way to stay minimally afloat. After her death, the Guardian newspaper suggested, and they probably weren't the first, that Israel's midlife plunge into criminality was, quote, less a dramatic moral decline than a symptom of decaying mental health, end quote. There were a lot of signs pointing in that direction. Maybe it all began when her agent suggested she find other means of employ after she submitted some very substandard work for him to shop around. And it continued unabated as she repeatedly would take to calling people in the publishing business, pretending to be the successful author and screenwriter Nora Ephron. Everyone she knew took Ms. Ephron's call. But when the call was answered or returned, Israel would shriek at them, always with expletives attached, suggesting in no uncertain terms that they were just interested in the famous rather than the talented. It got to be such a regular occurrence that Ephron had her lawyers slap Israel with a cease and desist order. So yes, we are talking a downhill slide of epic proportions. Maybe it began with Este. Maybe it began with her perpetual overindulgence in drink. Maybe she was having a genuine meltdown. But where did it end? Jersey died peacefully in her sleep, making matters, in theory, worse. But soon after, Israel found a kitten on the street, brought her home, and named her Doris. The flies had been vanquished when, after Jersey's demise, Israel had cleaned the litter. So Doris arrived to a fresh-ish smelling home, but alas, seemed to quickly develop some digestive issues. Israel had saved enough, $40, for the first vet visit, but needed more if she wished for more diagnostic clarity for Doris. Figuring she could use the few dollars that Soap Opera Digest paid her for an occasional piece, Israel went to the New York Public Library's Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center. This was sometime in late 1990. There, she asked for some materials about Elaine Carrington, the screenwriter and novelist who's also credited with originating radio soap opera, by creating the shows Pepper Young's Family and Rosemary in the 1930s. Israel thought there might be some good unplowed storytelling to do there. Instead, when the research librarian handed her the box of requested materials, Israel found an assortment of letters from funny girl Fanny Bryce to Miss Carrington. For those weak on theater history, Fanny Bryce was a comedian, singer, and actress who worked constantly during the first half of the 20th century. She was played on Broadway and twice in film adaptations of her life by Barbara Streisand. Israel began to read the letters. She found them funny and a genuine insight into Fanny's personality. For example, Bryce wrote, quote, "Everything is grand. We'll tell you lots and lots when I see you. I'm a much better actress than a writer, so I can act it out for you," end quote. Israel knew this letter had some value. It's small, maybe, but some. And it was in plain sight, given to her by a disinterested box carrier in a public space. Later, when asked about the impetus for a life of crime, Israel told NPR's Madeline Brand,
"It happened incrementally, like most evil things do. I needed the dome. I was in a lot of trouble. The proximate need for money had to do with my sick cat. I went to the library and was given a bunch of letters, which I should not have been given in a non-secure area."
She figured Fanny Bryce had literally leapt into her lap. What was a decent pet owner to do? Israel tucked three of Bryce's letters into a notebook and carried it with her into the ladies' room at the library. There, she folded them up, hid them in her socks and shoes, and, once having cleared the less-than-rigorous inspection at the door, headed out to find who might buy her pilfered goods. Her first stop was Argosy Bookstore, the venerable dealer near Lincoln Center. On the way, she concocted a story about how she had come to be in possession of the three letters. She made up a cousin Sydney, a world traveler and collector of curiosities. Alas, poor Sydney had died and left his cache of letters to his cousin Lee. She was free to do with them as she wished. Naomi Hample, Argosy's co-owner, personally handled the sale. She didn't press Lee about cousin Sydney and handed over $40 apiece for the Bryce notes. This was surprisingly easy. And like pickles out of a jar, it got easier. Israel went back to the library for more Fanny Bryce letters, tried out new dealers, and got Doris better. Actually, without ever having to dip into her ill-gotten cash. Hample and other dealers didn't just buy, they encouraged. They wanted more and they never asked about cousin Sydney. They even had helpful suggestions. Here's Israel again.
"Some of the autograph dealers told me that they would pay more for better content. So there was a big white space at the bottom of a letter after yours truly, Fanny Bryce. I got an old typewriter and I wrote a couple of hot sentences that improved the letter and elevated the price."
In fact, she eventually got a lot of old typewriters trying to match the font and spacing on letters she had lifted. This was a job in itself. The typewriters had to be in reasonable working order, and she had to be able to still find some ribbon for them. She went to work, adding funny bits to Fanny's funny bits. Soon she discovered, by stealthy means, that the letters she'd improved and had sold for less than $100 had made the rounds and were now being bought and resold in other Manhattan dealer shops for $595. She suddenly didn't feel so bad. She figured that there had to be a way to out-scam the scamming dealers who were clearly robbing her blind. The whole thing became a kind of in-house cottage industry. She went looking and came across a voluminous stockpile of letters from silent film actress Louise Brooks, who had retired to Rochester, New York, and wrote long missives to Herman Weinberg, a film archivist in New York. Those letters were in the Catherine Cornell room of the Performing Arts Library, a far more regulated space where Israel could make notes, but little else. It was now apparent that she couldn't steal them, so she started to practice her forgery signature skills in order to attach famous names to fictitious letter recipients to keep the money train moving along. She started by tracing Brooks's signature onto her own paper so that she might be able to practice at home. She made a light box out of an old, gutted black and white television so that she could backlight the trace signatures and make perfect duplicates. She had the amazing luck of finding extra blank pages of vintage paper inside other boxes of collections. When she moved on to other subjects, she noticed many letters were typed on stationery embossed with personal addresses. No problem. Plenty of printers in New York were happy to match the stylized fonts and print up a couple dozen sheets. Having been a proper biographer, Israel did the work trying to make sure the chronologies of the actual lives of the celebs fit the topics at hand. Israel even made sure that had a celeb misspelled something in a real letter, that the same misspelling occurred in the fakes. Soon enough, Israel set her sights on the writer and wit Dorothy Parker, best known as part of the Algonquin Roundtable, that famously sharp-tongued circle of New York literati in the 1920s, whose lunches were part brilliance, part blood sport. Parker's surviving correspondence was relatively limited, mostly from the period when she decamped to Hollywood to try her hand at screenwriting. That chapter of her life was well-documented, which gave Israel a clear record to mimic and fill in. For Israel, the quote-unquote work was quite lucrative. The forged Parker letters sold briskly and brought in real money. You should know that it's from one of those faux letters that Israel derived the name of her autobiography. She explained to NPR in 2008 that she created this Parker letter out of whole cloth. Here she is reading the letter on the air.
This one is Dateline Thanksgiving from Dorothy Parker. It says, "Dear Joshua, Alan told me to write and apologize, so I'm doing that now while he dresses for our turkey dinner with the boys across the road. I have a hangover that is a real museum piece. I'm sure that I must have said something terrible. To save me this kind of exertion in the future, I am thinking of having little letters run off saying, 'Can you ever forgive me, Dorothy? Can you ever forgive me, Dorothy?'"
It was golden. Israel moved on to letters she would create for the English playwright Noel Coward and the American playwright Lillian Hellman. She was particularly fond of novelist and short story writer Edna Ferber, but stretched to do some writing for screen legend Humphrey Bogart and philosopher-slash-writer Aldous Huxley.
"I used what talent I had and what voice I had to duplicate the voice and the letters of some very famous people."
By now, she had a raft of typewriters. Royals, Remingtons, Adlers, and Olympias, each kept in an out-of-the-way rented locker, each with a tag that indicated which writer had ostensibly used which machine for his or her letters to friends. Just a few months into her crime spree, she also had 30 autograph and memorabilia dealers nationwide welcoming her into their shops or corresponding with her by mail. Often, she would see the things she had fabricated in other venues, complete with some kind of authentication papers attached. Israel had no idea where those guarantee papers came from. She offered no such provenance. She just sold letters, and somebody, somewhere, had done the rest. Everybody was making money. Then, somebody began to ask questions. Quick break. Not for a sponsor, but for us. We've got something new to tell you about.
Yeah, if you love and want to directly support Crimes of the Centuries, but don't necessarily want all of Grab Bag Collab's other shows, we've made it easy to support just this one.
Our Apple subscription is now live. For $3.99 a month, or even less if you subscribe for a full year, you'll get every episode ad-free, plus behind-the-scenes bonus episodes you can't hear in the free feed.
Of course, that means you'll miss out on hearing me during the ads. And I thought we had something special.
Aww.
My comic timing, my soulful delivery. You're just going to skip it? Brutal.
If you can live without Scott's ad performances, the Apple subscription is the easiest way to support Crimes of the Centuries directly, skip the ads, and still get exclusive extras.
But if you do want more than just Kotze, if you like the idea of bonus content across all our shows, not just this one, go to grabbagcollab.com and subscribe there.
So whether you want to go all in on Grab Bag or just stick with Crimes of the Centuries, we've got you covered. Just search for Crimes of the Centuries in Apple Podcasts and hit subscribe.
Yeah, you're going to be
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Israel's winning streak had lasted about a year. By then, she knew many of her regular buyers, and some of those relationships had grown more than strictly transactional. So when one dealer invited her to dinner, ostensibly to thank her for the profit he was making from her collection, the conversation took a turn. He mentioned that West Coast dealers were balking at some of her Noel Coward letters. Seems that one or two of those dealers had known Coward and simply could not imagine that he would have been so cavalier as to reference, even obliquely, his homosexuality in even the most intimate of correspondences. At the time that Coward was supposed to have written those letters, homosexuality was still criminalized in England. It could mean prison time, or failing that, the option to undergo quote-unquote voluntary sterilization, because nothing screams voluntary like doing something under duress. The skeptics argued that Coward was never going to risk his career just to entertain his friends who had mailing addresses. Israel held her tongue during that dinner, and the East Coast dealer ended the evening showing his disdain for the West Coast dealers by passing the ultimate judgment on the letters. Quote, "They're real if we say they're real," end quote. Strangely, the whole episode had not ruffled Israel.
It was very good Coward. It was better Coward than Coward. I mean, Coward didn't have to be Coward. I had to be Coward and a half.
But the next development wasn't hers to control. Soon, nationwide radio host Paul Harvey was saying on air that the autograph market was about to face a big shakeup. Hints of her subterfuge cropped up. At first, it didn't hurt her business. But then came a call from Alan Weiner, a different friendly dealer, who told her he'd been called to testify before a grand jury looking into bogus letter fraud. He told her he wouldn't testify against her if she paid him $5,000. She set about looking for the money. She also knew one thing for sure. She could not sell letters in person anymore. She needed an accomplice. Enter Jack Hawk, a con man who had been in prison for hustling but had not taken the redemption route. He and Lee had had major doings a few years back when he had bought the film rights to Kilgallen but did nothing with them. Lee cooked up a new plan. Doctoring a former book contract, she managed to gain admittance to both the Columbia University Division of Rare Books and Manuscripts and the New York Public Library's Berg Collection. The latter contained the literary archives and manuscripts representing 400 authors. The false book contract gave her access to privileged records, as she'd been deemed by someone to have a legitimate reason to be there. This time, Israel would take real letters, then, with her forgery skills, she would copy them. She'd return to the library, place the copies inside the files where the true artifacts had been, and sell the originals. No one would be the wiser. Hawk, a pretty good salesman, would go around to her usual customers who would now likely associate him with Israel. They bought big. So big, in fact, that Hawk was able to make a serious dent in both of his and Israel's outstanding debts. And a bit of serious irony, a lot of those sales were made to Weiner, who was, in effect, paying Israel to pay him to shut up. But cracks were showing. Israel grew nervous. Her partner in crime was flighty at best. He was also seriously ill with AIDS and often unable to work because of the random, disabling array of things the virus caused. He took long naps in her apartment. He also had a habit of pushing his luck and her generosity. Once he sold a batch of forged Margaret Mitchell letters for more than twice what he told her, and he pocketed the difference. She called him on it. They soldiered on. Until July 27th, 1992, when Israel waited outside of a deli for Hawk to meet her after a bye. After more than an hour without any sign of Hawk, she anxiously walked out and into New York streets. Almost immediately, she was hailed down by two strangers who simply flashed their badges and said they'd like to talk to her. They identified themselves as FBI. She was not arrested. She offered them nothing. They told her not to contact Hawk. On her way home, she stopped to gather up her stash of typewriters and, I'm quoting from her book, quote, "I deposited them, one by one, in trash cans along a mile stretch of Amsterdam Avenue, watching the traffic to see if I was being surveilled," end quote. She had been the target of an FBI sting. A dealer, who Israel sniped, knew that Providence was not the capital of Rhode Island, had tipped them off. Hawk had phoned that dealer while agents were in his office, offering letters supposedly from composer Jerome Kern and novelist Thomas Wolfe. The dealer wore a wire for the buy. The feds followed Hawk back to Israel. University librarians were called in to verify that the originals had been stolen from their collections. Israel had been approached by the two agents in the street before subpoenas had been issued and before she'd been warned not to destroy evidence, which she had already done. The denouement was swift. She got a lawyer through the Federal Defenders Program and pleaded guilty to forging and selling some 400 fake letters to a wide assortment of dealers across the country. Pretty impressive for about 14 months of work. Somewhere along the line, she was told by someone that she would likely get 10 years in federal prison for her crime. She was petrified. Her attorney laughed. "You'll maybe get one." Turned out that Judge Robert W. Sweet of the Federal District Court in Manhattan sentenced her to 5 years probation and 6 months house arrest, then added he, quote, "never wanted to see her again," end quote. In later interviews, Israel said the house arrest was a breeze. She was already a recluse. Anyway, in a New York Times interview in 2008, Israel tried to equivocate. While admitting that messing with the citadels that were the NYPL and Columbia was wrong, in fact, she said big time wrong, she also said that those letters never misrepresented any large truth. Quote, "they were fun and nobody got hurt. And everybody made money," end quote. Argosy bookstore owner Naomi Hample disagreed. She said she lost thousands when she had to dump the fake letters she'd bought off Israel after the revelations. The stolen originals she had bought from Hawk had to be returned to their rightful owners. Still, Hample wasn't bitter. She called the whole thing a learning experience, saying of Lee, quote, "she's really an excellent writer. She made the letters terrific," end quote. But in truth, the harm was real, and it wasn't strictly financial. Every forged letter slipped into the archival record had the potential to mislead scholars, to make Dorothy Parker a little too witty, Noelle Coward too candid, Louise Brooks too confessional. For biographers and historians, those letters weren't souvenirs. They were sources. And corrupted sources pollute everything that flows from them. Even now, no one can say with certainty that all of Israel's fakes have been rooted out. Some may still quietly sit in collections, footnotes waiting to misdirect an unwitting researcher. That possibility, that her voice still echoes under someone else's name, is the real legacy of her crime. Somehow, Israel got a job copy editing at Scholastic magazine. She was glad for the work. In 2018, Hollywood took up the story, casting Melissa McCarthy as Lee Israel. The film, Can You Ever Forgive Me, did not soften the irascibility and unlikability of its main character, but McCarthy made her somehow pitiable. The actress was nominated for the Golden Globes for the performance. In an interview for the TV show E! Insider, Ryan Seacrest and McCarthy shared a popular opinion at the time.
And I kind of fell in love with Lee Israel immediately. Yes. Even though she's difficult and challenging, it's like, I just love
her. You root for her. You really root for her.
That's what I thought when I read the script. I was like, I don't know why I love her so much, because she's not doing maybe the nicest things, and yet I still loved her, and I'm just glad that, I hope that came across.
In a New York Times interview in 2008, reporter Thomas Mallon asked Israel how it had all happened. Israel replied, quote, I was not in the flower of mental health, end quote. NPR posed the same question. Her reply,
oh, I knew I was doing something wrong. I'm not a sociopath. Of course I knew.
So at least there's that.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Guardian observed in 2015 that, quote, literary hoaxes run the gamut of gray areas from misread satires, outright frauds, misappropriated material, end quote, and more. And they're nothing new. Remember, just a few years before Lee Israel started her scam, the world was duped by the so-called Hitler Diaries, as we discussed a few episodes back. Quick refresher, in 1983, Stern magazine in Germany paid millions for what it thought were Adolf Hitler's private journals. Historians pored over them, the press went wild, and then the truth came out. They were crude forgeries cobbled together with a fountain pen and cheap notebooks. The fiasco reminded everyone that even the best and brightest can be fooled, and that fake words, once in circulation, can do real damage. These forgeries happen so often that Johns Hopkins University maintains a collection dedicated entirely to such deception. It's called the Bibliotheca Fictiva. Christopher Salenza, dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, described it this way.
This is really quite simply the largest collection of rare books and manuscripts dedicated entirely to the history of things that are not true.
Talking with Earl Havens, the director of the Virginia Fox Stern Center for the History of the Book in the Renaissance at Hopkins, the two men explain that sometimes things get slipped into historical or literary works purposely, or rather incidentally, as scholars find holes in narratives and they create things to fill the void, or to explain certain phenomenon or chronicle an unknown history with something known, which is not what Israel did. But should her letters be floating around there, still undetected as fakes, they could be read as interpretive of the character who assigned their name to it. Criminal? Depends. Harvard English professor Lewis Menand writes extensively on literary pretenders. In a 2018 New Yorker piece, he makes the point that people don't much care about the use of broad literary license until they think they've been duped. And everyone's definition of duped is different. You know, did Malcolm X write the autobiography of Malcolm X? No, Roots author Alex Haley did, shaping X's words and experiences into book form. That doesn't mean the book is not considered to be X's story, covering the entirety of his life and experiences. But then there are cases where the line blurs into outright fraud. How about Tibetan monk Lobsang Rampa, author of The Third Eye? He never existed. That memoir was written in 1956 by a British plumber named Cyril Hoskin. Or The Education of Little Tree, a so-called memoir of Cherokee orphanhood. The author Forrest Carter turned out to be Asa Earle Carter, a Ku Klux Klansman and George Wallace's speechwriter. More recently, did James Frey really have a crack and alcohol-riddled childhood and harrowing recovery experience like he said in his 2003 book, A Million Little Pieces? Well, that's tricky. Oprah thought it was a memoir and touted it for her book club. Random House was originally pitched it as fiction. Frey said it was true in the larger sense of the word. Didn't matter. Oprah felt so duped, she made Frey come back on her show and explain himself. She was angry, but she didn't learn much. A few years later, she became enraptured by Holocaust survivor Herman Rosenblatt, author of Angel at the Fence, which she called, quote, the single greatest love story, like, ever. Turns out the story of his wife tossing him bread and apples over the fence at Buchenwald while he was enslaved with thousands at the time, all under intense Nazi scrutiny, did not sit well with the New Republic, which wrote about how the whole thing was just ludicrous. That went badly for Rosenblatt. The lesson? Oprah doesn't like being duped. So who was duped during Lee Israel's run at high-end autograph dealers? What she did was, at worst, literary impersonation writ small. And was there harm in that? For Israel, there was clearly fun. She often told how she was so good at the craft that she had fooled Noel Coward biographer Barry Day. In 2007, Day published a standalone book, The Letters of Noel Coward. It included two letters, Lee would later claim three, of her forged works in the volume. The hardcover, published by the very reputable Alfred A. Knopf, was edited after the revelations of her chicanery. The paperback quietly removed them. Israel was tickled. As she later wrote, quote, for me, this was a big hoot and a terrific compliment, end quote. After her Screw You book, that's her memoir, a review of which called it pretty fabulous, Israel gave a plethora of decidedly cheeky interviews about her little traipse through swindledom. All of this irritated the snot out of a lot of New York literati who did not find anything funny in what she did and how she got away with it, more or less. I'm going to read you two letters to the editor, both in the August 15th, 2008 edition of the New York Times. The first is from Eve Golden of Lyndhurst, New Jersey. Golden is the author of several theater and film biographies, including those on 1950s bombshells Jane Mansfield and Jean Harlow, as well as 1920s silent film stars John Gilbert, Theda Bara, and Vernon and Irene Castle. She wrote, quote, as a biographer, no, I cannot ever forgive Lee Israel, author of Can You Ever Forgive Me? Memoirs of a Literary Forger. The letters she forged make a mockery of writers' attempts to seek out the truth when researching books. But Israel gets a Simon & Schuster contract for her crimes and thinks the whole thing is a big hoot. As for me, I'd like to see her head on a pike in front of the New York Public Library as a warning to others. End quote. Then there's this from David Lowenhairs, one of those autograph dealers who helped bring her down. Quote, as the dealer who approached the FBI with his suspicions regarding Lee Israel's forgeries and theft of rare letters from Columbia University and who participated in the operation that caught her, I am appalled by the press coverage her book has received. Among the forgers mentioned in your review could be added the name of Mark Hoffman, the 1980s forger of Mormon historical documents, who not only defrauded dozens of dealers and betrayed his co-religionists, but murdered several people to conceal his crimes. Maybe he, too, will write a pretty damned fabulous book about his misadventures. Betrayal, greed, and immorality are not so amusing to the scholars, collectors, dealers, and institutions Israel hurt, end quote. So, no, not everyone found her exploits amusing. Israel died in 2014. Her obituary in the New York Times pulled no punches. It quoted her friend David Yarnell, quote, she drank an awful lot, she was an alcoholic, and she was very feisty and people did not want to work with her, end quote. It also quoted Carl Burrell, the FBI agent in charge of uncovering her crimes. He admitted he found her forgeries amusing. Quote, she was brilliant. My favorite was Hemingway. He was complaining about Spencer Tracy being cast as the main character in The Old Man and the Sea, end quote. Lee Israel would have agreed with that assessment. As she once famously said herself, I still consider the letters to be my best work. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Lee Israel's Can You Ever Forgive Me? She also read contemporaneous coverage of Israel's trial and the smattering of stories that came out after the film starring Melissa McCarthy renewed attention to the forgeries. She watched the film and consulted online archives that include samples of the forged letters Israel authored under other people's names. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.